Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Apeel. Apeel is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. Learn more at Apeel.com.
This week on Meat in 3, we're embracing the spooky spirit of Halloween, from zombies to witches. We're exploring the odd, the occult, and the taboo in the world of food.
There are restaurants with no storefront, shrunken down into hundreds of square feet versus thousands of square feet. No servers, no hosts, nobody taking your order.
The rats in the sewers are now smelling, all of a sudden, fresh food molecules. And those rats were like, holy cow, follow that scent.
Tune in to Meat in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay. And I will be recording momentarily. And are you all set, Jess? Okay. Here we go. This is What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are joined today by my favorite returning guest, Leah Douglas, who joins us once a month for the last 6 months to give us an update on her handy-dandy COVID map, where she has been mapping the outbreak of COVID-19 in meatpackers and food workers across the country. If you're not familiar with Leah, let me just give you a quick update on who she is so that you can follow her yourselves on Twitter and on her Facebook, on her, her website. She is a journalist who covers food and agriculture from Washington, D.C. She focuses on corporate power, consolidation, regulation, big business, and political economy as they relate to food, to agriculture, labor, land, and the environment. So you can see why I like to have her on, people, right? Leah was the 2020 recipient of the National Farmers Union Milt Haeckel Award for Excellence in Agricultural Reporting, and she was a member of the 2019-2020 cohort of the New Economies Reporting Project Finance Solutions Fellowship. She is currently an associate editor and staff writer at the Food and Environment Reporting Network, also known as FERN, F-E-R-N. If you don't know FERN, you should. And more importantly, you should subscribe because they are doing God's work in terms of journalism around all kinds of topics that relate to food and agriculture, as it says in their title. Anyway, Leah, tell us about the map and what the new data says, because you've just finished an update, right?
Yes, yes. Thanks so much for having me, Katie. And I am updating the map. I update it every day. And today's update, you know, as you said, just for context, for folks who aren't familiar with this project, this is a map and data set that I've been maintaining for the past 6 months, looking at outbreaks of COVID-19 at meatpacking plants, food processing facilities, and on farms and other production facilities. And so as of today, when we're taping October 26th, there's been almost 72,000 COVID-19 cases among the workers in those facilities that I've counted, and at least 327 worker deaths since March and April. And there's also been, over 1,400 at this point outbreaks that I've tracked to those three sectors. So we've seen a pretty consistent rise in new cases in these facilities. There continue to be some underlying data issues in terms of getting access to testing results from both, you know, food companies and also public health departments, making it sort of difficult to assess how we're doing in terms of keeping workers safe and improving the conditions. But there have been some interesting trends, which I know we'll talk a bit about.
Absolutely. So your most recent article talks about a potential surge in new infections. That was in FERN on, was that September 23rd? Is that right? No, excuse me, October 21st?
Yes.
Yes, October 21st. So in that piece, which was published in FERN, as I said, your article talks about a potential surge in new infections in meatpacking plants. Why is that going to happen? Since really, even though numbers overall are drifting upward over the summer, I think we saw a little bit of a sense of a plateau there. Why do you think we're seeing a new surge or likely to see a new surge?
Yes. So I was trying to understand, you know, the trends that we've seen in this data set over the past 6 months. And I've been getting a lot of questions about, we know that we're experiencing a third wave nationwide. We know that cases are rising extremely rapidly in most states at this point. So how is that going to affect the food sector and particularly the meatpacking and food plants where workers are working in very close quarters, where we saw those massive outbreaks in the spring? So with this story, I tried to evaluate the data that we've had and that I've collected over the last 6 months to try to draw out some trends. And what I found was really the peak of new reported cases was in the spring and early summer, when we saw the spread of the virus really unchecked in a lot of those facilities before there were any sort of precautions implemented in many workplaces. And we saw hundreds of workers getting sick in single outbreaks and thousands of new outbreaks across the country. So that was really the peak. And as you said, there was a little bit of a drop in new cases over the summer, which, you know, as I said, you know, there could be many factors contributing to that. You know, we saw a dip in new cases over the summer nationally, you know, so there's some correlation to the national trend. There's also, you know, the data reporting has been really poor from a lot of the sources where I'm getting this information. So, you know, I always have to factor that into, you know, it's hard to parse out whether there's actually fewer cases occurring, or if they're just not being reported. Mm-hmm. But all that aside, I took that information to public health experts and epidemiologists, and their assessment was, you know, it's they're very concerned about the potential for new infections and new outbreaks, in large part because we don't really know how well the precautions that have been taken are working. And we do know that with the rise in the occurrence of cold and flu season, you know, there could be complications to testing protocols that are in place. You know, one epidemiologist said, you know, testing is already very complicated in these workplaces, and there's actually disincentive in some cases for workers to be tested because they may, you know, have to quarantine at home and lose work and lose pay. And that, you know, may become even more complicated if, you know, a person is symptomatic, but, you know, maybe a plant manager or that worker might say, oh, it's just the cold, you know, I have to come to work, so I'm not even going to get my COVID test. So there's some concern that all these factors may build on each other, and we might see some new infections this fall and winter.
Let's remind listeners that and correct me if I'm wrong, Leah, but I believe that the CARES Act, which was the first relief act that they passed back in April, the money that was set aside to help out workers who needed to stay home and quarantine is now gone. Just as there is no more hero pay for coming into work, there's no more sick leave pay going to workers that do, in fact, come down with COVID or really any disease. Is that true, or am I making that up?
Well, we've definitely seen, you know, some of the company policies that, you know, particularly in the meatpacking sector, this has gotten a lot of attention, where there was the, you know, quote unquote hero pay, or, you know, incentive pay for workers to come into work, you know, to help workers make it through times where they had to, you know, quarantine at home, that some of those procedures and policies are being rolled back. And that's one of the underlying issues that, you know, that I always try to point to in my reporting is, you know, where there are some instances where actually companies took measures to protect workers or to release information that are now being rolled back, especially as, you know, there's an appearance of fewer cases and attention, you know, is in some areas moving elsewhere. So, you know, it definitely is a concern in terms of how will those rolled back policies affect workers' ability to get tested and to stay home when they need to.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, so as you said, some of the plants have instituted testing policies for their employees, although it's not clear how often or how regularly that happens. But what are some of the other measures that you're aware of that have been adopted to protect employees? And have they, do you think those have had any success in dialing back the outbreak, or are we just not seeing the reports of numbers that really would reflect whether or not they're successful?
So there have been a number of measures that, you know, I've heard, you know, reports that at facilities that have been taken. You know, one of the biggest, most visible changes is the prevalence of personal protective equipment, particularly of masks and face shields, which was a major concern at the beginning, in the beginning few months of the pandemic, when workers really had no access to that. So, you know, some plants have implemented physical barriers between workers, particularly the meatpacking industry has advertised their use of plexiglass barriers, which are meant to, you know, protect workers from each other. There's other measures like temperature checks when workers arrive at facilities, and hand sanitation stations. So, you know, a lot of those measures have been implemented. I would say that I've heard mixed reviews of whether the current measures are sufficient. You know, I have heard from several unions and several public health experts that there has been a reduction in new cases. You know, we're definitely not seeing the scale of the spread of the virus at these facilities that we saw in the spring. At the same time, you know, there's also pretty universal, you know, criticisms with some of these measures. For instance, you know, I've heard several reports that workers in some plants are provided with one mask per day, but in a meatpacking facility or really any facility, you know, that mask could be contaminated, get sweaty and so on, where it's really not useful anymore. And if workers need a second mask, they have to pay for it themselves. That's one, you know, iteration of that policy that I've heard. You know, when it comes to the plexiglass barriers, you know, the barriers themselves are not floor to ceiling. They're only a few feet. They're only a barrier if you're standing right next to it. You know, they're quite narrow. So, you know, definitely epidemiologists have called into question how effective that is when we know that COVID-19 is an airborne virus, and a small barrier like that may not fully stop the spread of the virus. So it's been mixed reviews, I would say. So there's some success, but really evaluating the success is difficult without the full data set.
And we're going to be talking about that in a minute. But in the meantime, a lot of advocates have been saying that slowing down the line speed, and by that I mean the speed with which animals move through the production process, slowing that down would allow for more distance between the workers, which would offer them better protection. Because as you just pointed out, those little plexiglass barriers that they're making a lot of public relations hay out of only go in between the workers. But as if you've ever visited a slaughter plant, you would know, as I do, that in 9 times out of 20, the table upon which the meat is moving is double-sided. In other words, you're not just looking out into a blank, into an empty room. You are looking 6 feet across at somebody else who is able to breathe directly at you and you at them. So whether or not you have a shield in between the guy who's right next to you is almost moot, because you are blowing your air back and forth between the person across the table. I believe that is true. So did you want to comment on that? And especially talk about the line speeds. I'm sorry, I got mixed up in my question, as always. But really, we're talking about the line speed here.
Yes, absolutely. And you're totally correct that, the proximity of workers isn't just side to side. It's also across the line. And that's also, there's a limit to how, that's a quite narrow space as well. So it's absolutely a factor. In terms of the line speed, there hasn't been a policy or widespread industry approach to slow down production lines to address this particular issue of how to spread workers out so they're less vulnerable to contracting COVID-19. The industry has really insisted that the line speed is not a factor in terms of spreading COVID-19 and that there's no greater risk to a greater line speed associated with, worker injury or worker illness. And that's sort of the industry line. I would say that from advocates, labor advocates and public health experts, I've heard that, distancing, physical distance is kind of the last big frontier that would really go the next step to really keep workers better protected than the current measures. Which are a little bit of a, there's a little bit of a surface level, hand sanitation, et cetera. It's important, obviously. But as we all know with COVID-19, the bottom line is keeping physical distance between ourselves and others. And so that's been described to me as sort of the next big step that could be taken. And there hasn't been indication that I've seen that plants have systematically implemented that policy. It's possible that individual plants have, but there hasn't been any type of industry-wide effort.
I also noted, I think it was in your article, I noted that some of the plants have indeed increased their line speed in order to make up for shortfalls in production due to so many workers being out of work or in quarantine. Is that accurate, that they have actually speeded up in some cases, looking for, sorry, go ahead.
There definitely have been reports of increased line speeds, and particularly, we know at the beginning of the pandemic that worker absence and illness was really affecting meatpacking plants' ability to keep up with their production levels. And there were some reports that at that time, there was efforts to speed up the line to kind of keep pace with the production needs. And there's been, I did a story a few weeks ago looking at a line speed waiver program that the USDA has that allows some plants to run their lines faster than the industry standard, and that there had been some waivers approved in April, while the pandemic was already underway. So there has been, if there's been any industry movement, it's been towards an increased line speed or maintaining the status quo.
Right, right. And of course, I want to remind people that increasing the line speed in pork and poultry plants has been a long sought after goal of the North American Meat Institute and all of the the Pork Producers Council, the Chicken Council, and so on. They all want to speed up the line speed. They've been trying to do it, I think, almost for over 20 years, if I'm not mistaken. But I think, I've been covering this, it's called the HIMP program. Of course, I can't remember what that acronym stands for, but HIMP. For listeners who are interested, you can go back and listen to some of my earliest shows, actually, when I first started doing this. I was talking about whether or not they were going to get away with implementing these faster line speeds way back when with the Government Accountability Project and the Food Integrity Campaign, which is run by the inestimable Amanda Hitt, who's always been a great source of information about these inside moves on the part of meatpacking. So with that, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Leah Douglas. We're going to talk more about an article she published just a few days ago, October 21st, in Fern, about sort of the potential resurgence of COVID in the United States food worker force. So please stay tuned for that. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Appeal. Here at Heritage Radio Network, we care about reducing waste across our food system, from farms to home kitchens. We know that about half of the produce we grow ends up in the trash. We all want to enjoy produce at peak freshness and reduce the amount that gets thrown away. That's where Appeal comes in. Appeal is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. It's edible, invisible, and imitates how peels naturally protect fruits and vegetables. Because here's the thing, less waste doesn't just mean we're throwing less food away. It also means we waste less water, energy, and other resources that go into growing produce. Appeal works with nature to reduce waste across the food system, from the farm to the kitchen. Appeal helps us conserve our precious resources to ensure we have fresh food to meet our growing need. Appeal, food gone good. Learn more at appeal.com.
This is, just in case you forgot since the top of the show, what you're listening to, which is something, quite honestly, I could do, but I imagine most people wouldn't. But this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. My guest today, Leah Douglas, comes on every month to bring us up to date on this incredible project, which, by the way, Leah, I know we talked about this the last time, but you've gotten so much play out of this. I mean, like, even meat packers are using your numbers to make themselves look good. You know, I mean, it's kind of ironic to me how successful in many ways this project has been outside of what I suspect you anticipated it to be useful, you know, or the people who would be interested in it, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's definitely been pretty incredible to see. You know, it's the data has been used, as you said, by the meat industry. There was some misinterpretation of the data and their North American Meat Institute's most recent use of the data, which I clarified on Twitter for anyone interested. It's been really gratifying to see the project get such a wide reach.
Yeah, kudos to you, my dear. Now, let's talk about North American Meat Institute. A spokesman for NAMI, who was quoted in your article, she claimed that the industry as a whole has spent upwards of $1 billion, that's B with a billion, dollars on protecting their workers. What exactly is she talking about, given that A, line speeds remain accelerated, B, plastic shields in between workers is not a universal fitting, not everybody has adopted that. Testing is not universal. So is she just talking about giving people masks? And you just said a minute ago that if they use more than one mask, they often have to make the second one out of their own pocket. So what is she saying here? Where is that figure coming from?
You know, it's a great question. And the meat industry has, you know, various meat companies have put forward different dollar amounts that they've spent in terms of navigating the pandemic. Some, you know, the coverage that I've seen in their press releases and so on has indicated that there's basically everything from worker testing to PPE to bonus pay to paid time off, all those different benefits, short term and long term, that have been implemented are all going into those calculations. I actually saw an article at one point that said, or I'm not sure if it was it was an article saying that Smithfield had spent $500 million alone on COVID precautions. So there's half the billion that she's referring to. So, you know, it's an interesting it's an interesting assessment in terms of how that dollar figure is being calculated. I think it's relevant insofar as that money, that figure is being put forward as a rallying cry for the industry to enlist government aid and government support and, you know, financial aid in terms of navigating the pandemic, and also enlisting government interest in meatpacking workers being first in line for a COVID vaccine is another interesting issue that's emerging. So, you know, I think everything is sort of being wrapped up into that that dollar figure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm struggling with that. I really am, especially given the fact that some of that money for, say, workers to be able to stay home and quarantine, for example, some of that money came out of the CARES Act. So, and that's not happening anymore. A lot of those people aren't getting that bonus pay or that pay when they stay home sick from work. So, you know, I'd love to dig in further with that. I wonder, did any of the union type folks that you speak with on a regular basis have any comment on that? Or was that just, she just came up with that and you kind of let it go?
You know, I haven't asked specifically about that spending figure. That comment came in request to, well, an interview request that was declined, but also more specific questions about protections for workers and whether the industry is anticipating a fall and winter surge. And there was no comment on that. So that's where that quote came from.
Very interesting. Yeah, really. I mean, it would be, I don't know how you could do that research. I don't know how you can get inside the financials of these companies. I know they're very closely guarded. But that would be a fascinating run down a rabbit hole, wouldn't it? So to go back to the testing for a second. So Tyson, at the beginning of the pandemic, they said they were testing extensively, and they have, I think, something like 180 plants working, functioning now in the United States. And then it turned out when you investigated a bit further, in fact, they were only testing in something like 16 of the plants. And that went, you know, clarify this for me.
Sure. So Tyson in the spring had announced that they were taking on a company-wide effort to test their workers for COVID-19. And it was a little bit unclear exactly what the scope of that testing program was. Their initial press releases said testing program was being rolled out at 40 facilities. And I later did an analysis that found that they had only released testing results from 18 facilities. When all was said and done. And that effort lasted, it was between May and June, essentially. And testing was done between like 1, 2, or 3 days at different plants around the country, different Tyson plants. And, you know, it was an interesting effort because it was, there had been criticism of the companies for not testing workers and not making that available. In the wake of that effort, Tyson and a couple of other meat packers have said that they are doing random COVID testing among their worker population to try to monitor for potential new outbreaks. That information, you know, I presume needs to be reported to a local public health authority because there is mandatory reporting in most cases for new illness occurrences. But that information isn't being released anywhere publicly for assessment by the public or by public health experts. So it's actually difficult to know exactly how extensive that testing is. All we have is what the industry has said about it.
Okay, I need to go back for a second to what you just said. So there is a mandate. In other words, they are legally obliged to release figures on their testing. Did I understand you correctly? But somehow not happening?
Well, just to clarify, so my understanding is that individual workplaces, when there have been instances of COVID-19, many states require reporting of those cases so that the state can keep track. And then the state makes a discretionary decision around whether that information is released to the public, which is, you know, something else that I've done a lot of reporting on is how many or actually how few states are taking that next step to then release that data to the public. So I'm just connecting the dots between, you know, the companies are doing testing and, you know, we know that most states do require to, you know, that the public health authorities know where in the state there are COVID outbreaks. But that final step of alerting the public in most cases is not happening.
Okay. So that's where we get to that. So the data from the testing gets to the state and then the state decides what it's going to do with it, whether it's going to sit on that information, send it into, I don't know, the CDC, or alert their public health officials. Your article said that only 4 states are reporting their data on outbreaks to public health agencies.
Yes,
how is that happening? I don't understand.
Sure. So that story, I essentially surveyed all 50 states to see what the public reporting and transparency looked like in terms of workplace outbreaks. Mm-hmm. So that's what steps states are taking to tell the public, the general public, where there are workplace outbreaks specifically. And only 4 states that I found were either making that information regularly available or would tell me, you know, where there had been outbreaks just in response to an email request. And there's a variety of, you know, there's maybe a dozen or 15 states that are doing partial reporting. So they'll either report an aggregate number of outbreaks at workplaces by sector. Maybe they'll report the number of workers in a sector who have gotten COVID, but not the specific workplaces or locations or companies. Some states will report how many deaths among workers. So it's really a patchwork response. And it's worth noting that, you know, the top public health authorities in the country have recommended that, you know, there's daily or weekly public reporting of workplace outbreaks of COVID in order to alert the public as to how the virus is spreading in their community. So these policies, you know, do run in tension with what top public health officials are recommending. So, you know, that's the next step that, you know, has been really a challenge in terms of tracking, you know, whether we're seeing new or sustained or decreasing cases in these sectors, is that without that final stage of public reporting, it's very difficult to know. And in my case, you know, I've started to turn to public records requests and so on to try to get some of that underlying information. But that can be quite difficult, as it's a lengthy process, and definitely every state has different requirements and so on.
Wow. I mean, I'm not to ask you to give up your trade secrets, but how exactly do you approach making that request? I mean, is it it's a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request? I mean, what, how, you know, I don't understand why it's, I mean, I do understand why it's difficult to get it. I guess my question really has to do with why are they not obliged to give it?
Yes, that's a great question. And, you know, a great, you know, example or metaphor that I've been turning to around this question of states reporting is, you know, the CDC has done a couple of reports on the meat and poultry sector, and actually the whole also farm and food processing sectors. There was a report that came out just last week that was updating their findings on how many workers have gotten sick. And in the CDC report, I think it was something like 33 states shared data. And that's based on a request. So, you know, even to the top federal authority, only 33 states are reporting, you know, their data on how many workers have contracted the virus. And that does not include information about specific workplaces and specific companies. So in terms of how this played out at the state level, you know, there's been a lot of pressure from business interests not to release information about where there's specific, which specific companies have had outbreaks. I believe the underlying concern being that it's bad PR, essentially. But certainly, you know, both, you know, the media and public interest advocates and also labor advocates have said that there's a major concern when we don't know which workplaces have had outbreaks. And there's been many reports of even workers at a specific company warehouse, et cetera, not knowing that there is a COVID-19 outbreak underway in their own workplace until it's reported in the media or until
they get sick. Oh, exactly. God, this is unbelievable. So one of the other things I just want to drill down on a little bit with you is that you pointed out in your last response or the one before that, that a lot of plants are kind of rolling back those earlier transparency measures and how they reported the data. I want to talk about that a little bit more. Like, I don't understand how they get away with that. How is that legally possible?
Sure. So I did a story that was looking at, you know, specifically states that, as you said, had at one point, and specifically over the summer, introduced more rigorous transparency standards for how they were going to share information about workplace COVID-19 outbreaks. And this goes beyond just the agricultural sector, but just to the broader issue of workplace outbreak reporting.
Sure.
And I looked at Kansas and Arkansas as two examples of states that had begun to that made a specific decision to start announcing company names, specific locations of plants that were experiencing COVID-19 outbreaks. And in both cases, within a week, that policy was rolled back. In the case of Kansas, their new reporting system was temporarily taken offline while there was an assessment of how to reconfigure it. And then when it came back, they're only reporting cases, I believe the most recent version is they're only reporting new cases from the last 14 days. So they're not releasing aggregate information about how many people have gotten sick at a specific facility. And in the case of Arkansas, they're releasing information about specific plants, but only the plant is identified only by sector. So in the case of For instance, a poultry plant, which has been there's been really rampant COVID-19 outbreaks in the poultry industry in Arkansas. It's just listed as manufacturing in their reports.
Wow.
And then I have to request from the state that they tell me which plants those different lines are representing. So, you know, there's been a lot of criticism by local and state, you know, media and transparency advocates who have really pushed for the states to do more reporting. But as I said, you know, the other side is industry, whether it's the meat industry or just local chamber of commerce, business interests who are really pushing back on that style of transparency and reporting. So it continues to be a major issue. There hasn't been significant headway in too many states on that.
Wow, that's truly chilling, because I mean, I personally consider that immoral behavior. I mean, it should be illegal. If it's not, I don't know why it isn't. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about the fact that, you mentioned that the CDC had not published any significant numbers that related to anything more recent than I think it was April or May or May or June in your article. But why is there no sort of federal coordinated response in the sense, you know, with a group of people who are dedicated to aggregating and analyzing the data on these outbreaks in meat packing facilities, on farm or in food processing? Whose job is that supposed to be? Isn't that supposed to be a CDC gig, or did Trump need to implement some sort of czar of COVID who would have been in charge of kind of tracking these outbreaks and bringing all of that information together so that public health officials could make a more educated response to, shutting the virus down?
You know, it's a great question. And just to clarify around, you know, what's gone on with the CDC specifically, the CDC has released essentially three publications, one of which is updating the prior, so sort of two mm-hmm. publications that are reporting cases and outbreaks in the sectors that I'm covering. But as you said, the data that they're aggregating only goes through May. So it's quite outdated at this point. And it's also a subset, as I said, of the 33 states that responded to the CDC's request for information about outbreaks. So again, you know, it's even further subset of the, wow, the true number of cases. And there's no, you know, there is no public database or other information available from the CDC or other federal agencies that are tracking these cases. It's difficult to know exactly why that's happening. You know, it's interesting to look at the state level, which is where I spend a lot of my time aggregating data. You know, there's a lot of discretion in terms of how the state public health authorities release information. You know, for instance, one of the big differences I look at is in rehab facilities and long-term care facilities, there's been far more specific reporting of specific outbreaks in those types mm-hmm. of facilities. So there's clearly a choice being made. You know, clearly there's, you know, the public health authority has the ability to report on outbreaks in those types of facilities. But we have not seen the same in private businesses. And often the reporting standards are different for, you know, a long-term care facility versus a private business. And again, you know, my understanding is that a lot of that has to do with how the business interests are weighing in on how the state should act. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the federal level, I haven't seen very much actually reporting on why and how. There's no federal agency that is keeping track of this issue, but it definitely hamstrings those of us who are reporting on this. And of course, you know, has precipitated and necessitated my database, which has become sort of the stand-in for what really should be a federal effort that could be much more comprehensive.
Absolutely. And do you, with your ear to the ground as it is, do you hear any chatter about the idea of establishing some sort of reporting mechanism that would aggregate state, you know, data from all 50 states? Or is that just something that we can, you know, assume will happen either never if the Republicans remain in power, or possibly if the Democrats assume power? Do you hear any interest? Like, what do the state officials say, for example? Are they just like, well, you know, we're just flying blind? I mean, I can't imagine the impact this is having on managing the virus when it comes to state government officials. I mean, it's just so patently unfair and unnecessary, and it has so obviously contributed to the prolongation of this disaster. I'm still trying to figure out why it's all being allowed to happen the way it's happening. Help me, Leah.
No problem. Well, in the answer to your question about whether I'm hearing any news about potential measures that would be taken to track this more rigorously, no, unfortunately, is the answer.
Okay.
I have not heard any indication about that. You know, one helpful insight that I got from an epidemiologist a few months ago was she was speaking about how there's been a real decline in the number of jobs at public health jobs in general. I think she said a yes. quarter million jobs have been lost in you know, maybe the last decade. And she, you know, really attributed the spotty and inconsistent nature of data reporting across the across the board, not just in the agricultural sector,
sure.
To a real understaffing issue, chronic understaffing in the sector. So, you know, that isn't to make an excuse that, you know, of any kind, but just to say that one piece of context is, you know, we've read a lot during the course of the pandemic that about how the public health sector is underfunded, has been chronically underfunded, and has really hamstrung our national response. And when you think about who at the federal level and the state level would be doing this type of tracking, would be doing, you know, the advocacy for testing and rolling that out, et cetera, you know, would really be people within the Department of Health and, you know, public health roles. So that was one helpful piece of context I received about, you know, why this has been so inconsistent and gives another potential contributing factor beyond just the industry's pressure.
Fascinating. Well, Leah, I guess we'll leave it there at this to be continued in a month. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing. Folks, once again, check out Leah's work. She's at Leah J. Douglas, right? Is that your
yes.
Twitter handle? Yeah.
Yeah.
She's great Twitter feed, actually. Everything I know, I learned from Leah's Twitter feed, honest to God.
I try to inform the people.
Well, really, I mean, honestly, I hope you get a Pulitzer for this. I mean, truly, you deserve it. This is amazing. And everybody is glomming onto the work that you're doing. And, you know, you should be appropriately recompensed, if not financially, then certainly reputationally. So thank you so much for making me look good by coming on my show so regularly. And we look forward to the next installment. Thank you so much, Leah. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Katie.
You bet. And thanks to my sponsor and, of course, Jess, my engineer. And see you next week, folks. To be continued. Stay tuned. So long for now. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.